I'll let our sound expert get back into place and let me know when you're ready to call it. We'll go ahead and call post-council session back to order. And we will turn the time over for in-service annual training hour requirement discussion to Director Scott Stevenson.
Thank you, Chair, Council. So there was a lot of legislation that was passed this most recent session, and we're just responding to those discussions and those bills that are now in law. As most people are aware, each officer is required to get 40 hours of in-service training annually. Well, House Bill 162, which was sponsored by Representative Romero, requires at least 16 hours to be designated to four areas. Three areas: autism training, de-escalation, and defensive tactics training. And it's supposed to be approved by the director of post. Well, there are a lot of agencies within the state, so it'd be very difficult for me to personally look at each plan and approve it per se. So what we've done is we've come up with course descriptions similar to a college catalog course, so that you as administrators can look at that description and say, okay, this class or this training course fits this criteria. And if it fits within that description, then it's per se approved by the post director. I want to make sure the council's okay with this approach, because I think it's probably logistically the best way to approach this law. Does anybody have any concerns with the way we're going to handle or manage this?
Director, do you want to... Sorry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how you're creating the descriptions of what the training would be?
Mm-hmm. We want to make it the description... I hate to use the word vague, but vague enough that a lot of courses will fit within that title. Because de-escalation, for example, is very broad. Not any one person can agree on a specific definition of what de-escalation is. If you look at just the way we apply the use of force, especially the old continuum or the current, the way we explain use of force and the tools that are available to an officer, it's all encompassing of presence, verbal, on up to the use of deadly force. Some descriptions do not include the use of force as part of de-escalation. So we wanted to create a description that is vague enough, but yet hits on some key points like tactical retreat, for example, or repositioning. We want that in there as part of an overarching discussion within de-escalation with those courses. So that's the approach we're making. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
Okay, autism training, which Representative Elison sponsored through House Bill 336. We're doing a train-the-trainer, in fact, today, right now as we speak downstairs. Working with the Autism Council of Utah, Cheryl Smith is delivering the training, and we have another course next week. Today there were 33 officers that registered for that class. And we'll do classes as needed, but the reason why we wanted to do a train-the-trainer, just so that we have the expertise within your department and they can provide that training within your agency. Domestic violence training, which was sponsored by Representative Perucci, we are working with the UPC to create a course. I think July 1, this next fiscal training year, it'll be delivered. But we're waiting on you at UPC to help us with that curriculum. Asset forfeiture, the same thing. We're waiting on UPC. While POST is mandated to create its own curriculum, after further discussion, we thought it would be very important for us to be on the same page as prosecutors. We shouldn't be developing training that is inconsistent with what they need to prosecute a case. So we're waiting for that course to be developed, and then we'll tweak it to fit the needs of law enforcement as we apply that to boots on the ground. The 40 hours of training requirement. Every year, officers are required to get 40 hours. That 40 hours is to make sure that their certification is whole and they're able to operate as an officer on the street. Basically, what we're saying with that hour requirement to the public is that this officer is eligible and should be serving Utah's communities. However, we have this, and I don't know where the policy came from, but it's a prorated policy. So if an officer is in the, you know, comes back into the profession for 2 months of that fiscal year, they're only required to get 3.5 hours per month. Well, that's not, in our opinion, the spirit of the legislation. In fact, the statute just says 40 hours of in-service training annually, regardless if you are work a week or the entire year. So we feel like the policy that we have in place may not be consistent with what the statute requires. Now, this is going to take a huge fundamental change in the way we require these 40 hours. So if somebody gets employed for a day, we're saying they need to get that 40-hour requirement so that they are able to serve the public. Any questions? I am going to request a vote of support for this because it is a huge change. Military deployment, we waive those training hours because we know that they're getting a lot of training within their deployment.
Colonel. So the mechanics behind this, if you were to bring someone back after they exceeded that time, you basically have to put them in 40 hours of training immediately, and then they can go to work. That accomplishes what we're trying to do.
Yes.
Director, are those 40 hours deemed or reviewed by the law enforcement administrator?
Yes.
So typically.
So the content outside the 16 hours now,
right,
is approved by the administrator.
And then to the point of the 16 hours, if it fits within that curriculum, the chief law enforcement official has the ability to determine whether that falls within that based on that summary guidance. If it falls within that, then that is appropriate. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
So, I mean, any further discussion on the 40-hour requirement? It is going to cause some strain, especially for the smaller agencies across the state. But we really believe that is the intent of the original statute. We should not have this policy in place.
Claire, if I hire somebody June 1, by the end of that month for the new fiscal year, I've got to have 40 hours of training.
Technically, yes. But there are, when we do our audit, you have a grace period as well. So what we're saying is you should not put them on the street without getting that 40-hour requirement. So if you creep into July, we just don't want them... I shouldn't say we all shouldn't want them to be serving within our communities without that training. I mean, for example, the discussion Captain Garcia brought this morning, if somebody is out of the profession they work and then they're out of profession for 17 days and or 17 months and a day or 29 days, they could technically come back, get 3 hours of training and be good to go. But 18 months is a long time. A lot of things change, especially laws, within that period. So we really feel strongly that 40-hour requirement is 40 hours before they serve the communities. So I'd like to... Any further questions?
Go ahead, Director.
I think it would be good to or wise to vote.
Okay.
To support removing that policy.
Do we have a motion to remove the current policy that is in effect?
I don't have any food in my mouth. I will make that motion that we remove the policy regarding the 40 hours, right?
Motion from Sheriff Chris.
Get rid of the proration.
Get rid of the proration.
To remove the proration. Do I have a second? A second from Chief Swanson. Any further discussion?
Hearing none. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Right here.
Have one opposed from Sheriff Newman.
Motion passes.
Thank you. Permission to proceed? Chair?
Please, sir.
Next item on the agenda is lawful permanent resident update. This was sponsored by Senator Maine. And then it was adjusted or amended in the special session under Senate Bill 1004, I believe. So prior to this legislation, unless you were a citizen, you could not be an officer. And now, with the recent passing of that Senate bill, people that are not citizens can technically be officers. We, from an administrative and a procedural standpoint, we found some challenges in trying to ascertain what is legal and what is not legal. In fact, one of the questions by Chief Carpenter was DACA, which is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. We did some research. Mr. Yockey did a lot of research on this. We found case law that prohibits them from possessing firearms. So we settled on the lawful permanent resident status. And the other advantage to having the LPR is that we can track that. The statute requires them to be in this process for 5 years. So that gives us a 5-year history for not only us to do a background, but you guys as employers to do a background as well and establish some history. So that's why we've settled on the lawful permanent resident status. That is also consistent with recent Supreme Court ruling that came out, I believe, out of New Jersey. That case is Sanchez versus Mayorkas. Is that right, Lieutenant? So
the federal law is what's precluding, just for clarity, is what's precluding DACA to possess a firearm.
Yes.
Not state law.
Yes.
So the 117th session, I don't know if this is being addressed or not in the current session, but until that happens, we're unable to allow those that are dreamer status to enter into the academy. Is that correct?
The original language in the Senate bill was LPR, and then it was amended on the floor by Representative Wilcox, and then we did research and found that there's a contradiction and we could not administer this properly or even legally regarding the federal law.
Thank you.
So, any questions? So, LPR for 5 years, then they are eligible to be an officer within the state of Utah.
Can I add one thing to that?
Yes.
On the DACA side, the reason that we push so hard for that, and I think it's important to understand that, it won't change anything because of the federal statute, but it's important to understand that a lot of these individuals have lived here much longer than 5 years. And so we have a better history of those individuals because many of them, other than from when they initially were born in a foreign country and came to the U.S., have spent their entire lives in Utah. And so that was part of why we pushed so hard for SB 102. So that's the backstory. I think it's important to understand that. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Thank you. All right, proceeding. Last council meeting, this council mandated that I create subcommittees to discuss use of force model policy and also a model policy for canine certification. Which both were sponsored by Senator.
I can't remember.
I see his face. Chief Thatcher, thank you. So anyway, we have concluded those subcommittees. And so I'll just, I think we have the use of force policy up first.
Yes.
If I could just recognize those that participated, Chief Wallentine, who is here, Mayor Troy Walker, who was not able to make it today, Sergeant Scott Lorenzen, Janetta Williams, thank you for your participation, Sheriff Chad Jensen, and representing the FOP was Ian Adams, Marcus Yockey, myself, and Scott Carver participated in the subcommittee. We had some very good discussions. Chief Wallentine put a lot of time into formatting this properly in conjunction with Marcus Yockey, but it's always good to have his expertise in this arena. Chief, do you have any highlights of the use of force. It was pretty straightforward.
It was pretty straightforward, and really...
He tried to... And may I add, sense of humor.
I'm happy to answer any questions about it. Director Stevenson told you it was a pretty good gathering of subject matter experts. And if you've seen the draft rule, it's pretty straightforward. I think the only question you might have is, well, why an administrative rule? And the committee felt very strongly about this issue, and then Director Stevenson, I understand, will introduce the canine draft rule here in just a minute. This is really patterned on something that Post did a long time ago when I was a member of the Post staff with respect to pursuits. The reason this is in rule form is because the statute says that Post shall establish guidelines. So it really sets a floor for what an agency can do. I want to emphasize that these draft rules, and the committee was very, very aware of this, they are just floors. They're not ceilings. So an agency can go beyond this. An agency can have a policy that's more restrictive or broader in any way that they choose. These are the principles that we agreed are minimal best practices for the state of Utah. Because they're an administrative rule, it gives this council much greater flexibility to make changes and to adjust as best practices develop or as you are informed by other opinions and want to make a change. You don't have to go running back to the legislature to make a change. You don't really have to convene a big group. You can simply vote on a proposed administrative rule. And as Mr. Yaki will tell you, he and I both have been through this process. Then you jump through all the hoops of the Department of Administrative Services, publish the rules. So that's about it in a nutshell.
Thank you, Chief. Yeah, in fact, Chief Wallentine and myself really worked with legislators to make sure that we could do an administrative rule because it does give us that flexibility to make that change. And as by statute, the director is responsible for creating rule with advice and consent from this body. So I think it's a good process for us to be flexible in changes that need to be made. Any questions about the use of force? Okay. I think we need a vote to change this to administrative rule.
So we need a motion to change to administrative rule. Do we have one? I have a motion from Chief Chad Silk. Do I have a second? A second from Spence Austin. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll go ahead and call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you. Proceeding to the canine administrative rule, there was a lot of discussion about this rule and how to apply it. And initially, I thought it was going to be a little easier, but there's a lot of different programs, a lot of different standards, and so there's a lot of healthy discussion about what should be in this rule. There's a point which is the qualifying section of this. I think we need to have a discussion with this body, and I'll invite Chief Wallentine to participate with your permission, Chair, regarding this this section. I think everything else we all agree upon, but what this qualifying section essentially does is it endorses a couple of programs. Traditionally and historically, Post has not done that. I know specifically I testified to this bill in some committees that I was going to treat it just like a waiver. An officer comes from another state. We look at their training. We compare it to make sure that it meets our standards, and then we approve that program. So the list is an internal document, not something that's put up on administrative rule or codified in law. That's what we've done historically. The qualifying does include a select few entities as an automatic approval by the administrative rule. So the discussion I want to have is, do we want to go this direction? And I'll let Chief Wallentine share his opinions about this because he's well-versed in canine. Chief, can you correct the phone?
pretty sure people can hear me from here.
Again, the talked about why an administrative rule gives a lot of flexibility. The statute that was written, and I was able to have a fairly strong participative role in drafting that statute, uses a term that may be unique to you. It's four words, qualifying canine certifying entity. And those words were very carefully chosen for the statute, and they're in the rule for a reason. It's not intended by this draft rule that the committee has brought to you, the subcommittee has brought to you, that posts need to take on significantly greater responsibility in the world of actually providing services for police canine certification. But post does need to serve, I think the role proper role for post is to serve as the gatekeeper for quality standards. We've had in this country, and I think a lot of people know, I get along with dogs better than people. I've written three books over the years on police canine training and legal issues. And we have some long-standing entities throughout the United States of America, including the United States Police Canine Association, the North American Police Working Dog Association, known as NAPWADA, and the California Narcotic Canine Association. Their full name is Narcotic Explosive and Patrol Canine Association. We've included those in the draft rule for one very simple reason. Their certification standards, their qualifying standards, are substantially similar to posts. And so what we're trying to do with this construct here is give chiefs and sheriffs, law enforcement agencies that have police canine programs, the ability to use pre-existing networks that have been established now for decades in the case of the United States Police Canine Association, to certify or to put dogs to the test. We all know what brought us to this stage, but I think it's enough to say that we just want to make sure that the police dogs that are out there on the street in Utah meet a certain standard, that when I say, and I'm no longer a dog handler, but if I had my dearly departed last dog and said, "Ouse," that dog would release from the bite. When I say to that dog, "Plutz," that dog would stop from pursuing someone or stop moving towards someone and would drop down on all fours. No matter whether the pavement was 120-degree asphalt, would be obedient. Those are the standards that we want to make sure that all of our canines in this state and all of our canine handlers meet. So that's why the rule was drafted this way. We felt that it says qualifying canine certifying entity includes. Again, we want to give post administrative staff some flexibility. These are just the three kind of big qualifying entities in the state of Utah. If we were to go, somewhere else, there might be another qualifying entity. But that was the purpose, and that's the reason you see some language that's a little bit unique, I think, in an administrative rule. I'm happy to answer any questions, Director, about the subcommittee's work or not. Thanks.
And for the record, post position is training outside of the state is a good thing. It brings in new ideas and fresh perspectives into Utah. So I can't argue or dispute Chief Wallentine and the reasoning behind this. It goes out of practice of what we've done. And he is right. This is unique language or approach to a situation. But I wanted this body to understand that it's not an endorsement per se. It's that these entities would satisfy the requirements of post and would save us some time in auditing. So not saying we wouldn't audit them, but it wouldn't have to be every single time an officer that had gone through this program. We'd have to go through that process. So.
Do you need a motion for this as well?
Yes, I would like one because we're putting into rule as well.
Need a motion to put into rule?
I think,
oh, go ahead.
Ms. Victoria.
I just have a quick question. So these are specific programs that you feel are similar enough to the standards that you want to implement that we're going to give them the green light on. What if there are other non-named programs that have similar requirements that would be situated similarly, and do you want to give yourself any bit of wiggle room such as Align, you know, and including other programs that meet the same standards so that you don't have to change the rule every time you encounter a new.
I
meet those standards.
I see your logic. Again, that's why I wanted to bring it before the body. I want this body to understand what the circumstances are and the way we have typically handled situations like this in the past. That's up to the council.
If we were to go that, go ahead, Ken.
Chief.
Do you mind if I speak to that? As the subcommittee drafted this, we thought about that. The fact of the matter is that most police service dogs that are in service in Utah right now are trained in the Intermountain West, and these are sort of the big three, in addition to kind of the big dog, pun intended, being the post staff that does certification testing too. But there's some great training facilities in Indiana, in Florida, in Texas, the Atlantic Northeast. Most of the time, though, chiefs and sheriffs don't want to spend the extra dollars to send their folks back to a more expensive, more travel costly program. But the way we drafted this, it was our intention, and maybe we hit the mark here. We used the word include to give the director, in consultation with his own internal staff, the ability to also recognize others. That's why I use the word includes. You know, I actually had in there for a while, includes but not limited to, but then the criticism was, well, now you're really opening it up. So it's really a word choice. And it's like Colonel Rapid said, you know, you got all these lawyers in the room.
I think it's just a matter, and this is, again, from my perspective, when we're trying to handle something like this in court, let's say you did have somebody with training from one of those Eastern entities that transferred, the program meets this. The fact that even though it says includes, to me that reads as almost a specific list. So I think that if there was additional language about similar programs that otherwise meet X, Y, and Z requirements, it might be a little bit helpful, but again, it may be that situation may be statistically insignificant as well.
One thing we made it so that the initial test is the same for each entity, correct, Director?
Yes.
So the test. Post will make the test for the initial, and then the yearly certification will also be the same test shared with those other two entities, as well as Post administering that. So that's the same throughout the group.
We're just going to get handlers in court if they've been to any programs outside of this, that's going to get tossed down, and they're going to say, well, these are the post-sanctioned programs. Your program is not within this. That's my concern.
Mr. McFarland, there will also be an internal document,
because as they come into this program, we're going to have to audit them if they are not on this in this administrative rule, just like we have with waivers. Every program that we audit goes on a list, and so it saves us time in the future of having to audit that program again for qualifying criteria. Chief.
I'll say one more thing, and then I think I've earned a free lunch. I can't make motion. I'm not on council anymore. That Chief Soap, who is a member of our subcommittee and represents the Chiefs Police Association, could make a motion to add a line there under 2A, that the director may approve substantially situated or equally qualified or substantially equally qualified entities as qualifying canine certifying entities. I mean, it's up to you, counsel, but we debated that and left it out, but I don't think there was any heartache about it. If the council put it back in, there wouldn't be any heartache at it. Something.
Or perhaps programs approved by the council.
Which probably would be good. And then, you know, so if there's something that comes up and it comes before the next council, then we just bring those programs up. So then if there is question.
I don't know if that helps, though, after the fact, with some of the court issues that I'm envisioning, that they approve it, but not until 3 months after
you
the fact.
You too late, is what
you're close saying. List. I worry about it. That's the only thing. I have concerns about that.
I would be opposed to having the director approval and then just
you letting us know, and if there's an issue, then we can.
Yeah, we can include that in a quarterly report.
Okay.
Programs that have been approved and vetted.
Yeah, just
motion that the director of post may approve other canine training entities that meet the qualifications that have been set forth.
That's fine.
Okay. Is that a motion?
That's a motion.
I got a motion from Chief Self.
Such language in the rules.
I got a second from Spence Oskin. To accept with the addition of, and then you would say.
And then I would say. Repeat it verbatim. I would say exactly what I said before.
That was brilliant.
The direction of the post director that any qualifying certifying entity that comes to post and wants to be added to that list would be added under his direction, and then he would tell the council about it.
Brilliant. Thank you. Or Chief Long kind of come up with
that. I like that. Teriyaki in our chat right now. I've heard a few, so.
I always worry about Chief Long kind of pontificating too much.
Ouch.
That's with love.
Sir, vote.
Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Thank you, Council. Thank you. But I'd like to recognize those that sat on the canine subcommittee. Again, Chief Wallentine, Sergeant Wendell Nope, who's our in-house expert in canine, Chief Choi Carr with Harriman City PD, Chief Chad Sof with Woods Cross, AG Spencer Austin, Colonel Mike Rappage, Sheriff Chad Jensen with Cache County, again, representing the FOP, Ian Adams, who's also a handler when he served law enforcement, Marcus Yockey, Steve Salas, who's captain with Highway Patrol, and then Major Tyler Cotter, who's now Chief Cotter over investigation set on this committee, as well as myself. So I appreciate the hard work that they put in. If I may,
thank you, sir.
Chair, proceed.
Please.
I wanted a discussion about medical marijuana and law enforcement. This is a kind of a difficult topic to navigate administratively as we approve applications and we have officers that come to us. And then also we're seeing an increase in inquiries about correctional officers being able to have medical marijuana. While it's legal in the state of Utah, it is still federally illegal, and POST is responsible for investigating violations of federal and state law still. So it still falls under USC 18, blah, 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 blah. Marcus Yockey can whip that out. Thank you. So it's very clear federally that it's still illegal. And there's a provision under CR what, Marcus Yockey? CRT?
What?
Basically, their administrative rule federally.
Code of Federal Regulations.
Boom. Whatever Chief Wallentine said. But in that, it's essentially like administrative rule, but only on the federal level, and there has to be a year absence of using that marijuana before you can possess a firearm. And that includes a medical marijuana card, which has to expire and been expired for a year to be eligible to carry a firearm. So it's hard for us to navigate what is legal and what is not legal. But I wanted to have this discussion specifically regarding the corrections arena. I can't remember who called me, but we had a discussion about, can a correctional officer have a medical marijuana card and we still employ them? In theory, yes, because they're not required to possess a firearm sometimes. Because they have SFO and this body has required SFO to be earned before they move on to corrections, every correctional officer has a special functions officer certification. That means they are eligible to work as an auxiliary officer, therefore carrying a firearm, and within counties, they carry weapons. I think at UDC, under transportation and other special assignments, they also carry weapons. So from a managerial standpoint, it seems very difficult, especially for a large agency, to manage who has a medical marijuana card, who has SFO, who's eligible to carry a firearm, and who is not. So I want to have a discussion as to how you want us to approach it and still remain within the confines of the law. What are your thoughts, especially with the sheriffs and even UDC? If they have SFO, they're technically not eligible, depending on how you use them. Now, by law, even though it's contrary to what the body approved, by law, they're only required to have a correction certification, meaning that's all they can do is operate on the floors of a jail or a prison, which would make it considerably easier for us if they only had that certification, because then by state law, they can have a medical marijuana card and still operate, depending on your policies, within that setting. And staff, interject if I've missed anything. Anything? No?
So the information right there, this is actually from the ATF. So this is their language. And then we added the additional 27, so CFR is Code of Federal Regulations, 478.11.
As a broader issue than even just the firearm issue, when they're being sworn, any officer, any attorney, with oaths to uphold federal and state law, where it's still federally a Schedule I controlled substance, how can that be reconciled? I don't know if it can.
I know.
That would be my position as well, as part of the oath of office.
Sure.
I'm not a federal guy. I'm a states' rights person. I always have been, and I believe in states' rights. I also can't believe I'm stepping up and saying this about this, because I totally supported not having medical marijuana in the state of Utah years ago when it first started to come about here. But the chief just made a very important comment about, would you want to have a deputy sheriff as a corrections officer with a medical marijuana card, or for that matter, a police officer? I guess I look at it two ways. The number one injury for police officers anywhere in this country are back injuries, and most of the time, those injuries, the doctor prescribes them narcotics or muscle relaxers or heavy types of drugs, and they're using those things. So I guess you have to weigh that. I think the thing that I think about most is what my constituents did in this state, and they voted for it, and they thought that it was I didn't, as a law enforcement officer and as a citizen, I did not vote in favor of it, but it was put out pretty loud and clear. And so I think we need to consider that, and we need to maybe change that. So as far as the federal regulations, that weighs nothing. In my eyes, I'm a states' rights person, so I believe in what our states and what this council does. So,
just to piggyback on that, I've lost and fired officers over the years. We got addicted to pink killers due to a surgery or whatever, and then they even were doctor shopping, but much more dangerous, I think, opioids, and have caused a lot more loss of jobs. And I agree. I mean, I'm not for it either, but. It's weird that we can have officers that are on opioids, right? It's, you know, for at night and then come to work the next day, but not on a medical marijuana. So.
Well, and as a council post, those are the rules of the game.
I'll give you an example for post policy. If a recruit is under any type of prescription medication that could impair their ability to make good decisions or operate a vehicle or shoot a firearm, we do not allow them in a car or on the firing range. That includes prescription marijuana, because scientifically we're just discovering new information about marijuana, but the level of impairment is there, especially as the toxicity level of marijuana increases. So I think the cleanest, this is just a recommendation, when it comes to the correctional environment, I think the cleanest approach is to only require the correctional certification. I think it'd be easier to manage from your end. And then from our end, on an investigation, if we get a complaint on an officer that's smoking marijuana, we can say, okay, they're BCO. We still need to investigate them federally, but when it comes to the meting out of discipline, it could be considered different because of the position they hold. I'm just throwing out an idea. Captain.
Smoking
marijuana.
Right.
Yeah.
Ingesting
according to
by state law.
Yes.
Right. You can't burn it above a certain temperature or whatever.
So, but law enforcement's off the table. Still, they have to possess a firearm. Therefore, federally, those are the rules.
So, we're talking about metabolite level. Correct. We're talking about if, because I guess that's the question. Because if we drug test, and you have an opioid, and then you look at is that in line with the levels, and then you've got an opioid that attaches differently to fatty. I'm not a scientist, but I do know that, as you say, it has a compounding effect. Mm-hmm. How do we make that determination? I guess that's my argument on the difference between the two.
Well, if we decoupled SFO and corrections certificate, that would be up to the individual employers. And
then we would deal with the aspect of whether they're doing it on you.
And then it would just affect the discipline, because we'd still have to investigate it.
Correct.
By state law. Colonel.
And I should know the answer to this, and I don't, but have we to address this at all differently with the dispatcher certification?
So that was another reason why we started discussing this. Because dispatchers are not required to, and we have to treat them the same within our statute.
So right now, they'd be held the 1 year
same
as well.
Standard.
Well, they wouldn't have a waiting
period. If they're using it proper and medicinally, the
That's right. They would not.
We adhere to the state law. So for dispatchers, we adhere to the same standards as any other citizen, because they don't have a, there's no firearm issue.
Right.
But because of the firearm issue, we have to adhere to 18 U.S.C. 922 and also the 27 CFR 478, which clarifies 18 U.S.C. 922.
But even above the 922 issues, even if you remove the firearms, isn't there issues, as the director discussed, regarding impairment and decision making? I mean, I understand that we're saying it's better than opioids, but to me, that's almost like saying, an 08 is better than a 1.6. So we're going to accept that and be okay with that in terms of, you know, under the influence of something.
And there's debate as to what level of metabolite. I mean, I have, unless somebody's read something that I haven't, I can't find consistency in what is a level of impairment.
Right.
Yeah. But alcohol has a set number that's been proven scientifically. Marijuana, this is a whole new path.
Any research in the states that have legalized marijuana and what they've done with their law enforcement?
Personally, I have not.
So Colorado, I actually have through IACP, and they actually deferred to a civil ruling, which happened to do with a cable company. It said that the employer had the ability to regulate what the standards were for their employee. Which
and that was
also,
a Colorado case.
Yes, correct. Yep. Which also fell to law enforcement, and that's actually what they utilize. So it was I don't know if it was a state. I'm not sure if it was appealed federally or not, but it is a state case. I do know that is currently what they use for the ability to regulate law enforcement.
That's out there regarding this.
Okay.
I've actually done research into it, and that's one of the cases.
Do you recall if that's a federal or state case?
I believe it was appealed to the federal level, but it was a state initiated.
It's currently in effect, I know that. I talked to Chief Dwight Henninger from the OPD, and he told me that's how they regulate it.
Yeah, and I think I read that a long time ago, but the liability lies with the employer, and that was the basis of that ruling.
The mechanics of the discussion, we're talking about requiring only basic correctional certification instead of SFO as well,
yes.
Which essentially would then allow an agency to hire someone and certify them if they had used medical marijuana prior to being hired within that year period.
Yeah.
It's really what we're drilling down to.
Yeah.
But that post-standard was 2 years.
That was pre... illicit use is still 2 years?
So is it the 1 year we're talking about the expiration or relinquishment of the card? Because what happens if you get somebody in on a card that was valid, but they said, you know, from January to December, and they said, oh, I had the card, it didn't expire until December, but I quit using February.
Yeah, so the ATF, they are very strict in regards to their interpretation of 27 CFR 478.
Another year, right?
And it is from the expiration
or relinquishment.
Or the relinquishment of a card. It is not from
use.
Use. It's an inferred use. If you look at the language in the very bottom paragraph, it is an inferred use, and so it is from the expiration of the card. I did find the case. It is a state. Colorado. It's Coach versus Dish Network, and it was in 2015. So it's a Colorado State Supreme Court that ruled in regards to that.
So, Director, you're looking for a recommendation?
I just threw out an idea. I'm not looking for a recommendation either way. I mean, it's difficult anyway. I'm just trying to make it a little easier on law enforcement generally, especially for those who employ correctional officers. But like, for example, just so you guys can picture this, right now it would be a category C. If the council pushed it to just BCO because there's no law enforcement or firearm attachment to this, it would push it to a category, actually it would be a category D, and it would be, it'd bump it down to a category E. So there's still going to be a disciplinary issue, but it just adjusts what the range is and what the council can met out. Yeah.
If the agency knows the individual has a medical marijuana card, statute says they need to refer a violation to post. So by not referring it to post, now we've set up another issue.
If they're employed, right?
Correct.
But if it's legal, Colonel and I just had this conversation, and we were saying if it's legal, then, and they're not employed, it changes once they become employed.
Yes.
If they're legally using it, we have to look at what that looks like. Because yes, we have those two separate issues, pre-use to employment versus once they're employed, what does that look like?
But see, even if, I'm just thinking out loud, even if there's a sanction administered, it's a letter of caution, and they continue to use, you're going to continue to report it to us. I don't know if there is a fix. I don't know.
You mentioned earlier potential collateral consequences for Giglio considerations.
Absolutely. So, I think it simplifies it to really look first at the pre-employment issue. And if someone has legally used medical marijuana, or in another state, legally used marijuana in that state, to at least be able to consider that in making a determination on pre-employment. Post-employment, once we've certified them, different set of issues. Right. But under this change, at least a correctional facility could consider hiring and employing someone inside of that year if they had legally used medical marijuana in the year prior to being employed. That at least opens that door,
right,
without super complicating everything else, I think.
Just as long as they're not issued a gun or anything like that. Yeah. Firearm. Similar communications or
dispatch. Right. I like that.
Russell, it would be difficult to decouple those because of the crossover in law enforcement activities.
But yes, also challenge of managing it on the other side as well.
And then so, is it a HIPAA violation to ask? I mean,
not for us. We're not subject to HIPAA. Attorneys check. If we are medical personnel, then yes, that HIPAA applies.
Just out of curiosity, do we have any idea how big the problem is? How many officers do we have in the state who do have medical marijuana cards?
We do not have a list.
Is it a big problem?
We're just hearing a lot more inquiries about it. Okay. And I'm trying to anticipate these issues.
Not necessarily inquiries about existing officers.
Potential
or prospective officers.
Okay, that's fair.
The two certifications. Because I use the heck out of SFO officers. And so would we have to send them some separate, send them early, have that after? Because I know part of the SFO curriculum winds up being tested in their basal corrections. So how do we make sure some of us that still want them to be that way? How does that look?
If this body wants to
separate them, then we would just make sure that everything that is as an SFO is isolated from BCO. But then they would get the BCO, and then you would have, as an employer, the decision whether to deal with the medical marijuana issue. I don't know any other way around it, other than what the colonel said, to tell you the truth. It's a very difficult administrative issue to deal with. I don't even know.
Again, once it changes federally.
Yeah, if it changes federally, then we have a whole other set of challenges before us. Could be.
I thought it was clear when they legalized the medical side of it, and it just seemed to make a lot more challenges presented for us. So I just throw that as a discussion. I don't need anything unless you guys want to take action or leave as is. We're good, right?
I make a motion to move the agenda.
Please.
Okay. Well, I can't vote. But.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Sorry.
I make a motion to move the agenda.
So moved. We have a motion to move the agenda forward. Do we have a second?
Yeah, we've got a second from Sheriff Curtis. Any? All those in favor?
Aye.
In the future, if you think of any ideas, please throw them our way, and we can have further discussions about this, because it's going to change. That's one thing we can guarantee. All right, proceeding, Utah Code 536211, that changed with Representative Stoddard's bill. If you can pull that up. Marcus, does he have 536211G?
We don't have
anything. Okay. Essentially, it says that a court or agency, if they find somebody to be deceitful, that rises to the level of a post-investigation outside of Garrity. So my question to this group is, where should that fall under the guidelines? Garrity's pretty clear, but now we have these other situations where somebody lies about paying child support, or I can't think of all the excuses or reasons for lying, but they would fall short of Garrity, but we don't know where they would fall under the set of guidelines.
So you're talking about G. Leo Brady, essentially.
Without saying that, yeah. I mean, in essence, that the people that are going to be investigated, this information will be used for a Brady Giglio list or tool.
So
Chief.
The law is written that if they come into a Garrity hearing and admit what they said, we don't have to send it to you? Is that what you're saying? Are you asking if we still need to?
Because it's still like a lie under administrative inquiry. So the feds, when they have defined what exculpatory evidence is, they include administrative inquiry. So if you pull an employee in, talk to them, ask them a question, they lie about it, that information has to be revealed. Well, now under this law, if you find that they lied under those
circumstances, the way I read it, you'd have to forward that to post.
But if they lied before and then told the truth in Garrity, then do we have to forward it to you?
I don't know.
So
it's still a lie.
Yeah.
Technically.
It necessarily says in violation of policy or in violation of state or fed law, right?
So it puts us in the policy realm.
So there would,
and that's where our struggle
is. The PO's employer. And so if it was dishonesty, unrelated to something within the scope of employment or the agency's policies, then it would be outside. So the classic example we've always kind of thrown around and used is, what about an extramarital affair? Has nothing to do with your job, still involves dishonesty. I don't know that that would be invoked under this, but I think it could potentially be relevant in Brady-Giglio determinations. But in terms of forwarding it, that's like another question. This is, seems to be limited to
policy. So policy could include, correct me if I'm wrong, extramarital affairs.
Right, but that's going to be wildly varying across agencies, would be my guess.
So would that agency require to report that to folks?
If they have a policy that says you cannot have an extramarital affair and they find out, it seems that it does require
it's
it.
It's very broad and very difficult for us to
apply a recommendation. Colonel.
In compliance with this statute, there's some things that are already built in. We dealt with one today. If they're falsifying a report or they're being dishonest in a report, that's falsification of the government record already captured. If they're being dishonest under Garrity, that would that's already captured. We're already addressing that. So, I mean, that's in the flavor of the law, even though we do those already. There's other, if they're determined by a court to be an uncredible witness or an untruthful or
they perjured themselves,
a ruling by a court, which would also be a criminal violation, which would capture it again in a lot of cases. I think, is there any others other than that one that actually have a court to determine that? And then you're right, then you start getting down into agency determination, and the chief's exactly right. You have an officer who says one thing, and then they rethink it and said, okay, here's what actually happened, and we've dealt with that. And sometimes you do with that disciplinary-wise. Those are the ones that are harder to define.
Well, and another
sticky point is when they submit an application, even though they're not certified, they lie on their application and then subsequently get certified. I mean,
it's very broad.
Could it be if an agency disciplines someone, we're talking about a court finds dishonesty. If we then go, if an agency actually disciplines someone for dishonesty, granted, there's a varying degree of interpretation there based on policy, but then you have an actual articulable action, but then that has to be reported in the post if discipline is issued by the agency.
It also depends on the agency, because I think the operative term is found by a law enforcement agency. And with that, I know that there are a lot of agencies that until the administrator actually issues that discipline, even though they've got substantiated, well-investigated complaints, if they resign or, leave prior to that, there's not going to be a finding. So this would not be...
But we do have to do that by statute.
But now we do. That catches the... thing. But I think it's a question about where in that process the referral is made, right?
But in the past they resigned so they could go to another agency.
Yes.
But now that's going to solve that. So would that still go to post? If they resign, you were going to discipline, but they left.
I think if an agency actually disciplines them, I think that falls under the statute then. That would be hard to argue that it doesn't.
But if you don't discipline because they left...
Yeah. You don't discipline because they walk out the door before you can hand them the documents.
Well, before the investigation was complete, the document wasn't ready.
But again, it still seems that that's a finding if you were intending to.
Yeah, but you completely deal with your house and you're supposed to give it to them.
Right. We still have jurisdiction over
the certification. Would this body be comfortable if we, with your permission, did some research and next meeting make some proposed language and then also a place where it should fall on the guidelines? We good with that?
Sorry about that.
For the next meeting, we would prepare language and also a proposal of where it should fall within the guidelines. Because I think... the more I hear these discussions, we need to create a definition for this. We may even need to put into a rule.
We were just talking about the word deception. What does that mean? That's this vague, ambiguous term that we're kind of like, what does that mean? So, it wouldn't hurt to have you guys come back with some language that we could look at approving. That would definitely be helpful.
Okay.
And also it'd be incumbent upon agencies to look very carefully at their own policies, because those policies are going to
different from agency to agency. So what you might do in one agency will end up here in another agency every night.
Yes. So back in 2010, prior to 2010, there was the entire statute said we were precluded from looking at policy violations, but then it had a catch-all section that if action caused a disruption within the department or community, then that would rise to the level of forwarding it to post, which crept into policy violations. So it was really broad as to the interpretation of the administrator, what they need to report to post. The reason why I wanted to get rid of that was to get rid of the inconsistency, and I feel like we're creeping back into the inconsistency because policies vary from department to department. So
the difference on this is we have a statute telling us to do it on this.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're back to where we are anchored to statute.
Yes.
Still.
Yes.
Yeah, but now agencies have to look at the
defined
policies.
By policy.
Yeah. What's that mean?
Oh,
we'll
see.
Okay. Sure. That's all I have. We'll come back next meeting with some language.
Thank you. That would be very helpful. Let's go ahead and move forward.
And thank you.
Go to the end post. Is Captain Garcia, please.
All right. I'll try to keep it brief here with my portion. So the first one up is dispatch qualifications. We've been in review as far as what post's role is and what should be required for post-dispatcher certification.
No, that's all right.
As you all know, post-dispatcher certification is a week-long course. There are some attachments that are currently required to gain that certification. One of them would be the BCI certification, which has to be done at the department level anyhow. In order for that individual dispatcher to access any sort of BCI information. They are also required the ICS classes, also known as the NIMS classes. I believe those NIMS classes are at some point also tied to some federal funding or money, so they're required to have that training regardless if they get the post certification or not. And then the third is the EMD, the Emergency Medical Dispatch certification or requirement. And that was brought into question by post as to whether or not that should be tied to the post certification. How it stands now or prior to a policy change, the dispatcher or the dispatch agency was allowed up to a year to get us those documentations in order to get their dispatcher certified, which means a dispatcher comes here for a five-day course, 40-hour course. And then we have to track them for an entire year, tracking down documentation from each dispatch center or each employer, which has turned into be a somewhat of a tracking nightmare when you're talking about all of the NIM certificates, making sure they're BCI certified, and then also with the EMD. The proposal with talking to the dispatch committee was to, from post standpoint, was to eliminate those three requirements for the post certification, as they would be, two of those three would be required by the dispatch agency anyway for them to be able to even do their job. They need to have the BCI training, and that falls on the department. There's no need for them to double supply documents. Your agencies or the dispatch agencies would already track that BCI certification. Same thing with the NIMS, that falls onto the department to verify that they've been certified in the NIMS. Dispatch has tried to move to get all dispatch agencies on board with the EMD certification. According to Carl, which is the chair of the committee, that they've had some good success in incorporating that EMD into the smaller PSAPs. And he feels that that may be diminished if it's not required by post as a requirement for post dispatch certification. You have that document in front of you from Carl and from the committee, showing that they are strongly support removing the two that I spoke of first, and then not so interested in getting rid of the EMD as a post requirement. So my question is to you as the council. What would be your recommendation? How would you like to move forward with the post-certification?
Council, please read the letter.
he doesn't articulate pretty well why they should keep it. Ours was just from a management standpoint, tracking that for a year. We have found that a lot of people don't recertify an EMD. In fact, what 20% don't completely fall through?
About 20 to 23%, I think it was, Camille. 22, almost 22% of dispatchers that come through with the post-dispatch program don't follow through with those requirements to begin with, whether that's because their particular PSAP doesn't necessarily require them to be post-certified or they wash out for some other reason. We don't have those numbers to dictate what it was, their resignation or they got fired or their agency just doesn't require it. But about 22% of them don't follow through with this. So we've got them open-ended on an open list for over a year and now have to go back and say, okay, now they're no longer eligible. If they happen to come back, they need to go through the entire process again, and then we're tracking them for another year. So it's more of a tracking issue. The reason they've been given a year in the past, from my understanding, is because that EMD course isn't necessarily the easiest course to get into. They don't offer it every 4 weeks or whatever, like 4 to 6 weeks, like a post-academy does or whatnot. So it's not, one, it costs money. It costs the PSAPs money to send their individual to EMD, and then it's not as easily accessible. And that's why prior to my time, they were given a year to complete all other requirements.
And we don't have software to track this. So this has to be tracked by Ms. Zabriskie manually by phone or email to ascertain whether they got it or not. So I mean,
that's why she's listening. So question, how many dispatch centers out there do not require a post-certification for the dispatchers?
I don't have that number by offhand.
So Chief Swanson, it's all over the board, and depending on what agency you're at. And so that's the problem, is why these requirements are put in place to create a unified structure. That is not the case throughout the state.
I understand that. I understand why the committee would want to keep that EMD in there.
So the ones that self-regulate will probably continue to self-regulate.
Don't require that throughout the state anyways. What's the purpose, kind of? We're not mandating that every dispatch center hire post-certified dispatchers. I mean, right. I think that's the direction we probably ought to be going, is to make that requirement. I understand there's going to be some rural areas that push back on that.
You want me to speak? Sure, please. I know a little bit about it. So the biggest difference is if you want to be eligible for public safety retirement, you must be a post-certified dispatcher. That's part of it. Not every agency requires that. I know the push is to have everybody post-certified as a dispatcher. But again, it's all across the board, and they use different software for EMD. And it's also exactly that other key part is getting the recertification. Not everybody offers it, so it's tough to do that. But I do know there is a push to get everybody on the same page.
But who's that push from, though, Sheriff? That push is from this bigger,
from right? Bigger agencies.
The rural counties are not pushing it, i.e. myself. I run my own dispatch center. I employ my own dispatchers, and I make the requirements for what they have to be a dispatcher. I've got some of them that have worked for me for over 20 years, and others that have just started. So we run it. It's how our community wants it to be done, and it's the best way for us. So.
And that's the hard part when you start getting agencies on the Wasatch Front saying this is how we need to do it for everybody, and it's the big push to consolidate them and things like that. That becomes an issue for especially the rural areas. They don't have the funding to pay for all that. It's hard to come up with that. So unless the state's willing to pay and give Sheriff Noel enough money to pay his people to put him in the state retirement system, he'd love to do it. But where's that money coming from?
I guess my point is if we're not requiring everyone to be post-certified, then what's the point of having the EMD still in there? Because my guess is agencies like my own are still going to require this. Correct.
Which I guess the second question is,
if they're not post-certified dispatchers, we don't see them before this board if there's an issue. So it's almost like.
We haven't had one since I became sheriff.
But there's no but there's no THC.
So let's be clear. We had one. We are doing that. We haven't had one. Of course, they made money
from Colorado. 911 tax and the funding that goes directly to DSAPs, as well as, of course, the funding that goes to support the infrastructure of the 911 system and the equipment in the 911 centers are paid through, you know, it's a 911 tax that the state oversees and the tax commission regulates. And I think the expectation is there is when you call 911, you get the same level of competency regardless of what 911 center you hit. And I think that's the impetus behind why we have post certification and EMD certification ought to absolutely be part of that. That's the expectations. When I get someone on the 911 line, they can handle an EMD call. And it's the same whether I hit one in southern Utah or northern Utah or anywhere in between. And that's the crux behind it. And I think we've seen repeatedly our legislature drive that message home with some degree of enthusiasm, and we'll continue to do that if we don't stay ahead of it.
So this recommendation, if I'm reading this correctly, is saying that they would do the EMD piece, but the other two would be self-rule. Is that correct?
Correct.
And sheriffs, I'd be curious as to where you're at on the EMD side.
My dispatchers go through the training, so I require them to do that, though, okay. Not right, the state no, or not anyone else. So, but they do go through it.
I think they should. We have a state and dispatch center, so I think it's a good thing.
I know they're apples and oranges, but for law enforcement, we don't require a pre-certification or employment to get into the academy. But we are for this. I understand what they're trying to accomplish, but it is a different standard.
So to give you an idea how policy is written right now, because we were trying to figure out how we could manage this easier, and it was to front load it and make the NIMS training and the BCI training and the EMD prior to them coming to the post class. Well, we got a lot of kickback on that because they said a lot of the dispatch centers said we would have to hire them a lot sooner in order to get them into an EMD class when we're front-loading a lot of stuff that they won't have knowledge of, and they're going to be flooded with information, and then they're going to be sent right to a 40-hour post-dispatch class. How beneficial is that going to be? So that right now in post policy, it actually says that everything will be completed prior to attending post dispatch, and that was recently changed. But that wasn't too well received.
So I guess the question for this body is, do we want to continue to have EMD attached to the certification? And the other question is, do we want to practice it before they get accepted to the academy or continue? That would make it administratively easier for us if we held that strong line that you have to have it before you come through the academy, right? Rather than right now of tracking it for a year and having 20% of those individuals not even follow through. We're still wasting time and effort to decipher.
So I guess this may solve this, and this is at least my thought. If a sheriff or chief in a rural area decides they don't want to have their dispatcher post-certified, it's a non-issue. If they want to come through and they want a unified standard, then impose the EMD. I don't think there's anything different. And then if 911 decides to give incentives to rural areas to help fulfill those preferenced mandates, if you want to call them that, then fund it.
Isn't that kind of what we did, Nate, when they told us we had to have two dispatchers on at any given time?
Right.
Same exact issue came up. So
they told us if we didn't do it, we didn't get the funding. So
and that wasn't only that didn't pass. Right.
That's not additional funding. That's just duplicate funding.
No. Okay.
So the
we have a motion.
So currently, you can work as a 911 dispatcher before you get post certification.
Yes.
all we're just saying is post certification will consistently mean this. And why would we not have it mean EMD certification?
Well, I mean, the whole idea behind post is standard. It is standard. That I think is important. I think it's important to remember it's the physical, it's the other things that we're saying you still have to pass a pre-physical entrance. There are requirements that you need to have to create a standard. Otherwise, it's post recommendations and whatever the hell else you want to call it. So, go, sir.
That we keep EMD as part of post certification. With a caveat, we'll get to the caveat in a minute, and recommend that we go ahead and keep the BCI and the NIMS classes with the local agencies. And then we pony up some money and buy her some software so she can track it better. She's not doing it by hand.
That's a legislative issue.
She loves you, Chief.
Do I have a second? Or
With the caveat? Or?
Without a second. I've got a second from Colonel Rappage. Do we have further discussion?
I was going to ask one quick question. Can you make that EMD certification an online course that they could do before they
get
there?
Great idea.
If you made that online, they could do that while they're in their pre-training.
Yep.
Get it here before they ever get here.
There would be no excuse for them not having it prior to entering the academy.
And it would still be consistent across the board.
So
I bet you'd get every dispatch.
Yeah, we don't, but is there a possibility?
Maybe it's not a virtual class for the COVID, but they're in person. That would be very difficult to do online. I was there a while.
Nothing's that we do online.
How many hours is it?
EMD?
Yeah.
4 days. 24? It's 3 days.
I think you can do it online.
I agree.
I think you can do it online.
Yeah.
And I think we need to make a recommendation.
We can't create a mandate.
Yeah,
I understand that. I understand. I guess that's what we need to recognize. We can't create a mandate for post. But I think we can make the recommendation. I don't know what that looks like.
We'd have to work with the
dispatch committee and try to put pressure on the entity that provides that training to see if they
can we make a recommendation that you look into what that would take. And then come back and report.
Yep, we can do that.
Do we want to require it prior to entering and have a firm stance on
that's
that, or just track it for a year?
That's not part of this motion until you come back to us with
okay.
the answers to the questions that the chair just
brought. Very good.
Okay. Any second, what she said.
So we have a second on the floor. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. Those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Other than post staff, sorry about
that. So that was to keep EMD attached at this point?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right, on to the second part. And John, speak up if I get something wrong here with this report. So a while back, end post, we did away with the end post. You guys elected to make that not a requirement any longer. Just to follow up as far as some statistics go, we have had an increase over the last 6 years as far as people leaving the academy or attrition rate. Currently, as it stands right now, across all academies, including ours and all satellite academies, we're at a 23% attrition rate. That's not specifically attributed to the end post. That's just across the board for whether they decided to leave on their own, whether the department made the decision, whether they failed out on PT, or whether they failed out on the testing process. Post is currently, our academy is at a 14% for this last year. We kind of also need to take into consideration why that number might be so high across the board and with post, simply because of COVID and having to go online and a different form of instruction. Previously, pre-COVID, post was at a 9% attrition rate, so got up 5% since COVID and having to go online. John, the correlation between the end post and the failure rate, I think on the testing was like 0.378. So statistically, 0.378 correlation is not a very strong correlation at all. So there was no way for us to say that end post was a determining factor as far as the failure rate goes. Any questions as far as...
I could say something.
So while academically there's a very low correlation between in post and academic performance, I was talking to John Jacobs, you know, the in post, even though you can't quantify what it does, but it also measures initiative and other aspects. In fact, John, if you don't mind kind of capturing what we discuss, it does capture other aspects than just academic performance.
So when we did the correlation coefficient, one perfect score would be one saying you get 100% on the in post, you're going to get 100% at academically at post. So that's a score of one. A score of zero would be there's nothing in the data that shows if you do good here, you're going to do good here. A negative one says if you are, say, high on in-post, you're going to do low. It's the inverse. So negative one is the inverse, one is the perfect. So a 0.378 says that it's a weak correlation, but there is a good correlation. So it does validate that there is some tie from looking at K through 12 education, and the assessment is the 10th grade level, and your ability to learn in the academy. So it does have some cognitive attributes to say that you do have the ability, if you can perform on a test, and a lot of it is obviously test reading and test question, but the MPost also has learning comprehension. There's parts of the academy that we don't have a statistical analysis on. That's the report writing, the ability to comprehend lecture, the ability to understand instruction on the firing line or on the defensive tactics mat. Those are all things that come that we just don't have any measurement on. So when we're looking at, you know, how do they perform, there is that some slight correlation, but it doesn't holistically look at the picture. What we did find is since we have taken the end post out, those that fail academically fail even better. They're lower. They were around 80%. Now they're down 78, 76%. Granted, we have a small sample because this has only been a year. So I think that's anecdotally what we're seeing in the academy is the directors of the satellites are recognizing, saying, we're getting people that used to fail academically very close to the 80%. Now they're falling down even lower. And so that was the kind of the gateway, I guess you would say, that the end post did hold, was to make sure they were at least close to the ability to pass.
Thank you.
Yep. The reason why I wanted to just give you this report and update is just follow through on that past decision. I'm not asking you to reinstitute the end post at this point because we do have a small sample. But we'll keep updating you on performance because you guys spent a lot of money getting them into the academy, and now we're going to see a higher rate of failure, and you're going to come down on my head saying, what's going on? So I just want to keep you apprised of what we're seeing in the academies across the board.
All right, that's all I have.
Thank you, Captain.
Recognition time. If I could have Victoria McFarland come up here. Victoria is leaving the council. She serves an at-large position, and she has done a fantastic job of serving this council and law enforcement community. I like the questions and the discussions that are had. She's not afraid to speak to the contrary and stretch this body's thought process, and I appreciate your work for this. So
Director,
I decide, yes.
Can we have a motion of declination so she can't leave? just saying.
I don't know. That'd be a question for Rich. So we decided to buy the best pen that government money can buy.
So it's a pencil.
It's real genuine. Reappropriated wood, maybe, but it has her name on it, so if it gets lost, they know where to send it. So Thank you so much for your service. All right, thank you. Now, the next meeting. Sheriff's conference usually is about the time frame in which we do these meetings. Is the sheriff's conference going to be in person? Yes, I assume.
In St. George.
In St. George.
What's the date, Sheriff?
The date is, help me out, Nate.
22nd through the 24th
of
September.
So if you wanted to have it down there, we can again have it up here. It's up to council.
Been many years since you've had it down there. I think we ought to have it down there.
It's a Tuesday through Thursday this year.
That may even help you out, right?
Maybe. So the 23rd afternoon after the roundtable? Is the roundtable on Thursday?
Yes, it's
open. 1 o'clock? Can we have
can
it
you guys,
right
you
there
guys have,
at the...
sheriffs have a meeting afterwards.
Yes, we have it. Well, okay.
So some of you have missed it in the past, but it's up to you guys. Throw out a time.
Tell us when to be there. We'll be there.
1300.
At the Sheriff Pulsifer's?
Well, don't they have the association meeting in that room?
We do.
So we'd have to find a location.
Well, and other times we've had it in...
We've had Santa Clara.
Chief Flowers facility.
Or at Dixie.
Yep.
So we can find a location.
Don't say Dixie.
Oh, sorry.
Polytechnic or something like that.
The University of Florida.
So where do we... We'll find a location to be announced, but everybody wants to do it down in St. George?
I am showing that as the elk hunt. Of you that
is
have priorities.
Oh, Colonel.
Director Stevenson has no regard for that one.
Okay.
I had to do the sheriff for that. Man.
The 23rd, correct? At 1 p.m., St. George.
Yes.
And to be determined, correct?
Correct. Ms. Gomez, just to be clear, those that have to travel there, if they don't get it on duty time, then we would cover their...
We just per diem.
Just per diem.
Lodging.
Okay. And lodging? Yeah. Per diem and lodging will be covered, but not the travel. So September 23rd at 1300, location to be announced. We good? Okay, it is in the schedule.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Victoria,
Counselor.
Thanks so much for your many years of service. You've done an outstanding job, and you always keep us on task. We're going to miss that.
I echo that. Thank you, Counsel. Have a good one.